All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fuckadelics? What the fuck tuplets? What? Yeah, how's it going? You guys, the what the fuck tuplets. Hey, it's Mark Maron. This is my show, WTF. Welcome to it. How's it going? John Lithgow is here. Yeah. Yeah, the John Lithgow. What is your first memories of John Lithgow? Scary, right? Usually 90% of the time, unless you grew up with Third Rock. I didn't. But for me, I think it's probably, could it possibly be Blowout? Oh, maybe it is. I just know it was, he can be a little scary. Even when he's not being scary, he's a little intense. He's intense any way you slice it. When he's scary, it's really fucking scary. When he's nice, he's really fucking nice. And when he's scared, he's really fucking scared. Great actor. No doubt. Great actor. Thrilled to have him. So he's here. What else do I need to tell you? I would like to encourage you to get tickets to my London show. I'm not begging, but it would be nice. I was there, maybe I was there a year or so ago, and now I'm back at Royal Festival Hall, April 6th, 2019. That's this week. And it's a 7:30 p.m. show. I believe there's still tickets left. I think Birmingham, there's a few left. I know Manchester sold out. Birmingham on the 8th is, there might be a few left there. Vicar Street in Ireland, Dublin, April 11th. I hope that those, I think there's a few left. Don't know. And then I've got dates coming up in San Diego, in Madison, Wisconsin, in Burlington, Vermont, in St. Louis, in Raleigh, North Carolina, and some more dates will be added. You can go to WTFpodTour.com. Is that right? WTFpod.com/tour. That'll get you those links. So look, I'll be honest with you. I'm going to read some emails because I'm doing this a few days before I leave. You're listening to this on Monday probably, so I recorded it a few days ago, like the day before I left for New York. I don't need to confuse things, but it's not last night. It's a few nights ago. Because I'm traveling tomorrow, I'm trying to pack for the Europe trip. Because I want to take is a carry-on. Because checking bags is such a fucking mess, and you just don't know what the fuck is going to happen. But I'm going to be gone for a while, so how do I pack? All right, I'll do laundry on the road. And even though I got a little cash in the bank, I'll probably go to a fucking laundromat if I can find one. You know why? Because I don't mind spending a few hours at a laundromat. I don't mind engaging with just sitting there, looking at the dryer, thinking about how clean my clothes are going to be, and just like I'm doing something out in the world. I should do more of that. We should all do a little more laundromat stuff. So, you know, I make mistakes. We all make mistakes. I'm willing to admit my mistakes most of the time, stubbornly. Sometimes I'll hold on to them for a little while, depends. But in a second, I'll address some apparent mistakes. But this one was, this was just a question from, who's this, from EW. Subject line, how do you know? Hey, Mark, I'm listening to you interview that actor who plays the Punisher, John Bernthal. You were asking him about self-doubt. I was listening to you push the topic and push the topic and push the topic. I was beginning to feel uncomfortable. I just felt uncomfortable when you wrote that three times. Just then, you switched to asking him about meeting his wife. How did you learn when to switch topics? It seemed like a great time to switch. It felt like you squeezed the lemon right to the edge, then switched. I know I will get stuck in a topic when talking to people. There seems to be a real art to jumping from topic to topic. Any tips? Thanks, EW. Yeah, when you're looking at them as you're saying the thing over and over again, and they appear annoyed or glazed over, or they kind of shut down, or they don't hold your gaze anymore, or they walk away, or they just look at you like, what the fuck is wrong with you? Those are all indicators of time to switch topics. Also, this is an indicator. If they say, could you quit asking me that? That's an indicator. Or this one, what the fuck are you talking about? That's a sure sign that you might want to move on. Or how about this one? Yeah, I don't feel comfortable talking about that with you. Yeah, but see, like, the thing is like, you can read all of those things that I just said on someone's face if you're paying attention. You can also, like, there are faces for fuck you. There are faces for I don't want to answer that. There are faces for not comfortable. You know, it's a mixture. But I'd say one of the tips is if they say shut up or move on or don't talk to me about that, that's a good time to to not talk about it anymore. Here's another email, Rob Lowe interview subject line. Hey, Mark, I've enjoyed just about all of your 1,000 podcasts. So this is coming from a fan. During your interview with Rob Lowe, I noticed a derisive tone in your voice whenever you discussed his new gig as a game show host. In fact, there was a good amount of contemptuous laughter on your part, which your guest gracefully ignored. Of course, you have every right to judge someone for their choice of occupation, but during those parts of the interview, I think you came off sounding like a dick. Still a big fan, Carl. P.S. 100%. Well, Carl, you're 100% misreading that. Mr. Lowe and myself had a nice time. Sometimes I change tones to sort of more connect with the guest, and I thought Rob Lowe could take a little ball busting, which he could. You didn't see him smiling. You didn't see him laughing. He's got to sell the show. He can't, you know, look, I know how he feels. We know how he feels. I mean, it might be a great show, but come on, man. It's a giant mechanical arm that's throwing people around, stops in front of questions. Give me a fucking break, dude. It's not a matter of judgment. It's bizarro and funny. And yeah, I was slightly derisive with Rob Lowe because that's what it required for us to fucking have a good conversation. Just trust me a little bit. Jesus Christ, is this derisive, Carl? How does this feel, Carl? Because I don't think this is derisive. I think this is annoyed. If I'd be like, come on, Carl. I mean, are you like really? You're mad about me making fun of the game show, Carl? Are you seriously? Are you really upset with me because I made fun of the giant arm amusement park game show that Rob Lowe is hosting? Are you really? Come on, Carl. I mean, really? How'd that sound? I think that was more what I was doing, and I have no problem with it. Here's one, language landmine. So this is where we get into making mistakes, as we do, especially if you're old enough to be set in some bad habits, perhaps, or the ones that you don't even know you have. Dearest Mark, in your intriguing interview with the charming Phoebe Robinson, both of you used words that could certainly be offensive to native peoples. You said off the res to describe somebody having a possible psychotic break, and she said tribe, referring to belonging to a group. I'm not in any way politically correct or a ball buster, and I was not personally offended. However, I thought you would find it interesting how even those of us who are trying have yet to parse the institutionalized racism against our most marginalized groups from our casual language. That is a fine sentence. The fuckery of our cultural legacy is embedded in the very words, no matter our intent. Thanks for all you do. I enjoy virtually hanging out with you and your guests twice a week. You feel like a good friend I've never met, and listening to you has helped me know myself better and grow. Sincerely, Daniel. Okay, you're right. Language is important. Language is powerful. Language can do good things. It can do bad things, but it does get in there and dictate, you know, movement of culture. It dictates a lot of things, especially through repetition. And I get it. These things can evolve. But when I read yours, I was like, yeah, I kind of understand what he was saying. And then I got this email. Off the res, 4 question marks. Glad I stuck with listening to the full show. Surprised to hear you say off res. The interview with Phoebe was so thoughtful. Surprised you made the comment in real time after that interview. Think you need to address the comment. K. Okay, I know now. Off the res is not good because it's offensive to native peoples. I'm sorry. I will not say it anymore. Not a problem. It's out. I removed it. But these two emails were reasonably toned. And I think that obviously I can't expect much from bullies on the right, but I can expect something from bullies on the left, in the sense that if there is a teachable moment or whatever they call it, then do it, teach it. I mean, don't condescend and belittle and indict somebody for you know, saying something that they may not have known was wrong. It feels good. I know there's a lot of hopelessness and powerlessness in progressive people right now, but that doesn't mean you need to condescend, bully, or indict people for things they might not understand. You know, just say these two emails were reasonable. And they weren't like, you fucking idiot, you fucking racist, you fucking piece of shit. Don't you know what you just did? No, I didn't. I didn't know. And if you talk to me like that, I'm not going to keep doing it, but I'm probably going to just shut down and not really taken in, and then secretly resent you and think you're a condescending, self-righteous douchebag, even though I get what you're saying. You know, I'm not going to like the way you said it, and who the fuck are you to talk to me like that? So if there is a teachable moment, I was just talking to somebody I made up in my head, by the way, you know, teach it. Teach it nicely. Teach it empathetically. Teach it like, you know, like somebody who cares. All right, look. Oh, you know what? I didn't get to talk about this. Last week, my congressman, Adam Schiff, did an amazing thing in a hearing in Congress, sitting next to a bunch of Republicans and just really giving it to them. Just talking about, it was sort of like, you had to watch it. Go look it up. Adam Schiff, you know, amazing sort of almost rabbinical rant in the hearing there in Congress about Russia. And he says, it's not okay. And like all it was really missing, being a Jew and having grown up, you know, going to synagogue sometimes in congregation, it really felt like a classically Jewish responsive reading. It felt like that. Here, I actually found the text of it, and I swear to God it will work. It would be perfect for synagogue. My colleagues might think it's okay that the Russians offer dirt on the Democratic candidate for president as part of what's described as the Russian government's effort to help the Trump campaign. Then the congregation goes, it's not okay. You might think that's okay, congregation. It's not okay. My colleagues might think it's okay that when that was offered to the son of the president who had a pivotal role in the campaign, that the president's son did not call the FBI. He did not adamantly refuse that foreign help. No, instead, that son said that he would love the help with the Russians. You might think that's okay. It's not okay. That he took that meeting. It's not okay. You might think it's okay that Paul Manafort, the campaign chair, someone with great experience running campaigns, also took that meeting. It's not okay. You know what I'm talking about. You know what the rabbi says something, then the congregation answers. Hey, you know what? Thank you, Adam Schiff. He's a nice guy. I think he's a vegan because of cholesterol issues. Anyways, listen, John Lithgow is here. He's in the new film adaptation of Stephen King's Pet Sematary, which opens this Friday, April 5th. He's also on Broadway with Laurie Metcalf in the play Hillary and Clinton at the Golden Theater. It's in previews now, and opening night is April 18th. Enjoy, Mr. Lithgow and myself.
Okay, so you're wearing a Steppenwolf jersey, and I know why.
You do know why?
Yes, I do.
Why? How do you know?
Because I'm working with Laurie Metcalf right
now. Oh, that's right. She'd left her Steppenwolf jersey, or her hoodie, in my old garage.
By mistake? Or
yeah, and it was her favorite thing.
Uh-huh.
And it was sort of a thing, you know, and because she was doing the play on Broadway, the women, what is it?
The Three Tall Women.
Three Tall Women. And she was very upset that she'd left her hoodie, and I arranged to have it sent to her ASAP so she could have it. And I told the story on the show, and they sent me one.
Great.
Well, I mean, what is it when you think about Steppenwolf as a stage actor, you know, because like in my mind, it's just sort of like there's an intensity, man. There's like you think of Malkovich. And you think of like even the next generation, or Joan Allen and Tracy and Laurie.
Yeah.
There's this intensity. There's this rawness. There's a, you know, and it's sort of a school of thought.
Yeah, it's kind of like the Chicago School. They brought those productions to New York in the late 70s.
Yeah.
And it was like this brace.
Steppenwolf did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This bracing breath of air from Chicago. There's a certain defiance about it.
The Windy City.
Yeah.
The Angry Wind.
When I was in high school, there was a big hit show on Broadway called From the Second City.
Yeah.
And it was
a review?
It was the Second City Review with Alan Arkin and Barbara Harris.
Wait,
and
when you were in high school in Ohio?
No, I went to lots of schools, but I finished high school in Princeton, New Jersey.
So you were in New Jersey.
Yeah.
And that was sort of just the Second City Review would have been just post the Compass Players.
Yeah.
Right.
And they came to New York and performed on Broadway and made this smash hit, but they would come down to Princeton on Monday night.
Yeah.
Their night off, busman's holiday.
Yeah.
so they could just improvise instead of doing a polished Broadway show.
And you saw
and there
Arkin?
I was in a tiny theater. I saw Alan Arkin when he must have been about 29 years old.
Oh, my God.
And
was it it was all comedy?
Oh, yeah. It was just flat out hilarious.
Wow.
And very interactive improv. It was just not polished at all.
Right.
I was in like the second row of this like 150-seat theater.
Yeah.
On the Princeton University campus.
Yeah.
I was just a high school kid.
Well, I mean, were you acting in high school?
Yeah, I mean, I was acting and acting and acting.
Yeah.
I was in a theater family. I grew up, my dad produced a regional theater.
Sort of where?
Mainly in Ohio in the 50s and 60s. He created Shakespeare festivals. There's this.
What part of Ohio?
Yellow Springs, where Antioch is. I lived in Waterville, outside of Toledo.
Were you born in Ohio?
No, I was born in Rochester.
Did you spend time in Rochester?
No.
None.
I was gone by 2 years old.
Yeah.
Yellow Springs is the closest I have to a hometown, although it only lasted till I was about 11.
Why all the moving?
Well, my dad was a theater producer, and they kept on...
Well, that's not the military.
It was like the opposite of a military brat. It was a theater rat upbringing. And his legacy theater is the Great Lakes Theater Festival in Cleveland, which still goes on. He started it in 1962 as the Great Lakes Shakespeare Festival.
Wow. So how did he start in it? Was he an actor? Or
He acted and directed, but principally he was the artistic director of all these theaters. And he ran the McCarter Theater at Princeton for about 10 years.
Uh-huh.
When I, round about the time, the first pro job I had, I mean, with an equity contract, playing proper roles, was working for my dad at McCarter.
Yeah, how old were you?
That was about 24 years old.
But you grew up in the theater?
Mm-hmm.
Just wandering around the theater, was your mom involved?
Just as a kind of keeping it all together. She had started out acting, but I never saw her act. She had quit... She had four kids. I mean, we were a real gypsy wagon.
Wow.
And she just kept it all together.
And like your dad would just pull up stakes and say, we're going here.
Sometimes he pulled up stakes. Sometimes he was run out of town. Sometimes he got a bigger, better gig and we moved on.
Why would he be run out of town, John?
Well, the theater would go belly up and they hadn't paid their payroll taxes or whatever, you know. I mean, it was crazy. Oh, none of which I knew about as a kid. We just packed our suitcases and got into the station wagon.
And it seems like he was on some sort of mission. There must have been some sort of belief in the magic of it, that Shakespeare was necessary for people to be decent or something.
He absolutely loved Shakespeare. He was a kind of shy, isolate kid, that's the lore in our family.
Uh-huh.
And somewhere around 15, 16 years old, he discovered Shakespeare and read the entire canon, start to finish.
Have you?
No. Come on. It's like reading the dictionary. But he was passionate about it, and he so fervently believed in it. Let me describe his most successful venture with Shakespeare. It was about an 8-year long Shakespeare festival in Yellow Springs, Ohio.
Yeah.
This troupe of actors who would perform outdoors on the main building right in front of this big, beautiful Victorian Gothic brick building.
It was an extended porch or something?
They sort of built a unit
platform?
A unit stage.
Uh-huh.
And in the course of a summertime, they would open 7 Shakespeare plays in 9 weeks, rehearsing in the day, performing at night. And once all 7 of them, 7.
Yeah.
They opened them all, then they ran them in rotating repertory, a different play every night of the week.
So he had a Shakespearean company.
Yeah.
Of
they
people.
Were mainly young, fresh out of the oven graduates of Carnegie Tech. Now Carnegie Mellon.
Okay.
And really good actors.
Yeah.
I mean, you probably wouldn't have heard any of them, their names now, but theater actors in the 60s and 70s, these were the major
guys. They went on to be the big guys?
They were just tremendous. And I, you know, I always thought, how good could this possibly have been?
Yeah.
And, you know, just throwing together a shake, an entire Hamlet in 1 week.
Right.
You know, when I became a young and pretentious young actor, I sort of dismissed it in my own memory. And someone sent me a reel-to-reel tape of one of the productions.
Really?
Like Merry Wives of Windsor.
Just out of nowhere?
A comedy, yeah, where not a single joke is comprehensible to a modern audience. And you heard these young actors performing out of doors, no amplification.
Yeah.
And the audience roaring with laughter, and the acting was fantastic. It high energy, fast as lightning, and with incredible diction. It was just exhilarating. And sure enough, it created this incredible success over many years. People would come from all over the country to spend a week and see.
In Ohio.
Southern Ohio.
It's weird because, not to be condescending, but you don't hear about Ohio being a cultural mecca anymore.
There are
pockets.
You
everywhere.
Cross
sure.
this country, it's amazing how many pockets there are.
Yeah, there's just like, you know, it's easy to do what I just did is just where you draw these lines where like that state.
But I know, but I mean, these Shakespeare festivals still exist all over the place in Utah and.
Yeah.
God knows San Francisco and Ashland, Oregon. That's
a big place.
That's
yeah.
a big, big deal over the years.
And what's your relationship with Shakespeare outside of not having read the canon? I mean, I've talked a lot on this show with people about how I just can't, it's hard for me to access.
Yeah.
And then Sir Ian McKellen did it to my face.
Mm-hmm.
He did Shakespeare right to my face.
Did it bring you around?
Yeah, well, I mean, sure. I mean, I understood it. I felt the emotions of it. I can understand it. It's, you know, if I listen, but it's staying in the pocket.
You have to give it time and you have to understand about a Shakespeare play when you go to see it.
Yeah. You got to know the story.
If you're seeing it fresh, you're not going to understand the first half hour.
Right.
And then bit by bit, the story emerges and you begin to appreciate what a great storyteller he was.
Right.
But the trick of Shakespeare is, he was a poet.
Yeah.
I mean, he had all these devices for captivating an audience.
Yeah.
A lot of it had to do with the beauty of the language.
Right.
But if you see pretty much any Shakespeare play, some of it is in verse and some of it is in prose.
Right.
Tends to be a sort of class system.
Right.
The noble characters will speak in verse.
Oh, yeah?
And the supernumeraries, the bit parts.
The rabble.
Like the gravedigger in Hamlet.
Yeah.
They'll talk colloquial language. And it's the language of 400 years ago. So you have to. It's like watching a French movie with subtitles.
Yeah.
You sort of gradually get into the rhythm of it. And, you know, what I've always, my little paradigm for it was that Shakespeare and all writing for the stage is a combination of three things.
Yeah.
The meaning, the emotion, and the music. The meaning is simply making it comprehensible.
Yeah.
And that's not easy with Shakespeare.
Right.
You have to get an extremely willing audience.
Yeah.
That has some, but it's it's amazing how untutored people can actually be swept away by it.
Sure.
The emotion is just the emotion of the characters, the interaction of Iago and Othello and Desdemona.
Yeah.
And the music is the extraordinary sound.
Of the language.
Of the language, which is why we are still quoting it. Which
right.
is why Ian McKellen sat here and...
And he can do it.
And sort of dazzled
I think here. he did a piece that was about immigrants, I think, from...
Yes, right.
From Thomas... Moore? What is it
called? It was
called?
A sort of discovered piece of Shakespeare.
Yeah, right,
Thomas Moore. It was
Thomas
a
Moore,
play
right.
about Thomas Moore.
Yeah, he did it right there, as close as you are to me.
Yeah.
Just look at me right in the eye.
Yeah.
But how often do you do Shakespeare?
Rarely.
Yeah.
I did King Lear a few years ago.
You were King Lear?
In Central Park.
That's a lot.
A fantastic experience. And I did Malvolio with the Royal Shakespeare Company in 2007.
Uh-huh.
But before then, I had not done Shakespeare since I was a kid. I think 1975, I was Laertes in Hamlet in the park. I don't know. Other things come along. You know.
What did you learn from Lear? I mean, what was your experience? Because that's one of those things where an actor is ready to take it on. You have to be a certain age, and then it will reveal itself to you. What was revealed to you, John, from Lear? What did you come out of it feeling different about?
Oh, it just felt incredible to finally stand and deliver.
Yeah.
That language is titanic.
Yeah.
And the emotions are huge, especially for an old man.
Yeah.
And it's true, you have to be old enough to play it, but you also have to be young enough to play it because it's so incredibly demanding.
Yeah.
And I did it on the young end. I think I was 69 years old.
I know. Wasn't Olivier near death when he did
it? Yeah. And McKellen is doing it for the second time in about 15 years. I guess last year he did it.
Well, you're one of those guys, too, that's always seemed to be somewhat middle-aged your entire life.
Yes. I remember auditioning for a director named Stephen Porter in New York, I think probably before I had a New York job.
Yeah.
And I was auditioning for the young romantic character, secondary role, in a Molière play.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, you're going to grow into yourself as an actor.
Yeah.
He said basically what you just said. I've always been old.
I didn't say old.
I think that comes from growing up doing. I mean, I did do a huge amount of Shakespearean acting as a kid, right up until I was like 19, 20.
Because your dad would throw you in stuff.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Including when I was a little boy playing Mustard Seed in Midsummer Night's Dream.
Well, was there when you did that, like? Like having this, like it seems like your father must have been a passionate guy.
Yeah.
Was he?
He certainly was when it came to putting on plays.
Right.
Yeah. But a man of tremendous passion.
But at home, a little detached?
Oh, he was very sweet.
Yeah.
He was just a sweet and genial kind of calm guy. But boy, you see him play these bravura roles in Shakespeare.
Oh, and they all came out?
I used to imitate him for my friends in grade school.
Yeah.
You know?
Your dad acting. You would imitate your dad acting.
Yeah, playing Stefano in The Tempest, you know, the comic drunkard.
Uh-huh. He really opened up, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
Huh. Yeah. And did any of your siblings get into the business?
Well, both my sisters were teachers.
Yeah.
But they did a huge amount of theater in the schools.
Uh-huh.
In fact, my older sister, Robin, she became the arts administrator of the whole unified school district here in Los Angeles, creating arts programs, including theater programs for kids.
Oh, that's noble.
It was noble, and it was a huge success until 2008 when
they took the money away.
All the money went out. So her job became supervising the dismantling of the programs that she had created.
Heartbreaking.
One of those real tragedies.
That's where they decided to take the money from.
Well, it tends to be the first thing to go because it's not to all appearances, it's not the thing that leads to academic success and career success.
Might lead to a decent children.
It feeds the soul. It's the other half of an education.
Well, that seems to be part of your life now. You do a lot of stuff for the kids.
Yeah. Thank you for noticing. That's sort of my hidden career, flying under the radar.
Well, let's go back. So when you're a kid, are you just picking up acting by being around it?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I loved the whole atmosphere. Me and my siblings and even some of my best friends, we considered these young actors in their mid-20s and early 30s our best friends, you know.
Well, that's interesting. So you had this input from these young people who are in that zone of self-discovery. In what years was this? In the early 70s?
Principally the late 50s, early 60s.
Okay, so the culture hadn't broken up yet, but in the sense of like people doing their own thing, man.
Well,
almost.
Yeah, I mean...
I guess my question is, were these guys kind of like these men and women that, you know, were sort of mentoring you just by proximity? Were they a wild bunch?
Not really. Mm-hmm. I mean, no more than most actors are. They're young tearaways. They had a lot of fun.
Yeah.
It was not... The revolution had not arrived.
Right.
In those years.
Right.
When I started acting seriously for my dad at 18, 19, that was literally in 63, 64.
Right.
And that was just before the deluge.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. But you felt it coming? Did it, like, was it?
No, no. We were in this little extraordinary little bubble.
Right.
Everything was about Shakespeare,
right.
About acting.
Yeah. And so you're just picking up pointers? Yeah. How do you learn to act at that point? Like, I mean, like.
You know, I was not, I certainly didn't intend to be an actor. I didn't want to be an actor.
Yeah.
I was an artist. I was a very serious artist.
Painter?
I painter and printmaker.
Uh-huh.
And I intended to
in
do
high school.
That in high school.
Yeah, very serious.
Well, I was going to commuting from Princeton, New Jersey into the Art Students League to draw nude models.
What's the Art Students League?
In New York.
Oh, yeah?
It's a great old institution on 57th
Still
Street.
Still around?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah? Yeah. And they just went to, what do, take classes there?
Yeah. I mean, I took a sort of teenager's drawing and watercolor class with a bunch of really good School of Visual Arts type in New York City kids.
So that was the goal to. But you're always going to be an artist.
Well, at that point, I did woodcuts and I had extremely good public school art classes back in those days.
Yeah,
but I went to Harvard.
Yeah,
mainly because I got into Harvard. It's which was if you seriously wanted to be a painter, that was the completely wrong thing to do.
Well,
because you don't study art at Harvard.
Had your family gone to Harvard?
No.
You just were a smart guy.
I just got in.
Yeah.
I had such a unique childhood, I suppose.
Uh-huh.
I was such an oddity. And I was, I acted and I painted. I was an interesting kid.
Yeah. And what was Harvard? What year was that at Harvard?
I started in 63, graduated in 67.
Uh-huh.
And as soon as I got there, I fell in with the theater gang, and it was all extracurricular. You didn't study it.
Right.
But there were tremendously talented kids. And
Was the Hasty Pudding doing things?
The Hasty Pudding was kind of beneath my dignity.
Oh, right.
I was a very pretentious and
woodcutter.
I was an aesthete.
Yeah.
I was playing Tartuffe.
And, was it a troupe of theater major actor.
Yeah, and there was no theater major. We just ran off and did our thing. But at least two-thirds of my waking hours were spent. And not just theater, but I directed operas.
At Harvard?
At Harvard. I was the president of the Gilbert and Sullivan Society. I did patter songs in like six GNS operettas.
Uh-huh.
It was just this 4 years of just exuberant, fervent, unsupervised creative activity for a young performer.
And what were you actually majoring in?
English, history, and literature.
And did you do well?
I did fine. Yeah.
I guess they're connected, you know?
Oh, they're definitely connected. But I went off from Harvard. I went right to London on a Fulbright grant to study acting at Lambda.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I could have gone right into the profession, but for one thing, I wanted to go to England.
Yeah.
I'd never been to England
before. And the American Repertory was not in Harvard.
No, it was not.
Yet.
It was not there was no professional troupe in that Loeb Drama Center. It was all students. It was our big clubhouse.
But you had a stage.
We had beautiful facilities. We had professional supervisory staff.
Yeah.
A staff designer, a staff tech director.
So they gave you all that. So they encouraged
it. They gave us, although we stood in and worked. We spurned their advice. We were really arrogant little pricks.
Yeah.
Back in those
days. I think that Harvard, that's not unusual.
No, it's an abiding characteristic of Harvard grads.
It's part of the application process.
Yes,
how they decide whether you're right for the school.
Just how arrogant are you?
Exactly. So you got a Fulbright to go to England and study at which place?
At Lambda.
Which stands for what?
London Academy of Music and Dramatic Art. It's one of the three or four kind of pillars of the community.
The
over
big
there.
One. One of the
there's
big ones.
RADA, Lambda Central, and...
What's the difference?
Lambda's the best. no, they actually, there's very much a traditional academic training in England. There always has been. certain basic things you study.
Like?
RADA is the one with the Royal Charter. Oh. And it has had all sorts of major, you know, the late Albert Finney as of yesterday. He was a RADA grad.
You know that guy?
I never met Albert Finney, no.
He did some good work.
I exchanged wonderful letters with him, but I never met him. And Tom Courtney and all these. Lambda was always regarded as sort of the proletarian alternative to RADA, but now their status is absolutely the same. And Lambda's an incredible institution.
So you're coming in with a lot of Shakespearean experience.
Yeah, but I haven't put it to work much.
Right.
You know, just a couple of productions over the years.
And when you say academic in terms of the training, what is that like? What does that mean? How they start you out? What do you got to
learn? Oh, my God.
Sword fighting and dancing?
Absolutely. Sword fighting, historic dance, stage movement, voice, diction, and different classes for diction and vocal projection.
Yeah.
And a lot of scene work. A lot of Shakespeare, Chekhov, Shaw.
Uh-huh.
It was a classical training, you know. Lambda has this D group, this one-year group.
Yeah.
Which sort of compacts the entire 3 or 4 years.
Is that what you did?
That's what I did, and then extended the grant for another year.
And did what?
Hung around London. You know, it was an incredible time, end of the 60s.
So that's when it all breaks open.
It was breaking open then, for sure. And the theater was incredible back then. This was when Peter Brook was doing, he was a young man. And Peter Hall was the director of the National Theater, and Trevor Nunn became the youngest director ever of the RSC.
So you're just hanging out and you're going to those things.
Going to everything.
And
you know, the school was 9 to 5 every day. It was really hard work.
Yeah.
And then the second year when I'd completed that 1 year program, it was Vietnam time, and I wanted to hang on to my federal grant as long as I could to stay out of the war.
Right.
And I said, renew my grant and I'll find something to do. And I worked.
That kept you out of the war?
Up to a point. And then at a certain point I was drafted anyway.
You were?
Yeah.
And what happened?
I just got out of it. Pure acting. That's what it was like
back
in those
days.
As if
your life depended on it.
As if our lives depended on it.
So with the federal grant, you were somewhat protected because they weren't going after people who were engaged at that level?
Well, it was, if you stayed in school,
you were
protected up to a point. It was just after I got out of the draft that the draft lottery came in. It was an incredible, intense year, that particular year. 1968, 69. If you think about watershed sort of benchmark years in American history, 68 was right up there. I mean, that's the year that Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy were assassinated in the Democratic Convention. And Nixon beating Humphrey and Watergate, all the seeds of Watergate was 4 years later. But there I was in England for 2 years thinking, a lot of the time thinking, what am I doing here when the country's going all to hell?
Did you feel, was it a similar feeling to what we're feeling now?
Everybody thought the center was not holding, that the whole country was falling apart back in those days. I mean, there was a tremendous anti-war and anti-draft movement. I graduated from Harvard, and literally everybody I know found a way to get out of the draft.
So you're in England, and you're going to theater, and you're seeing all this great stuff, and how do you know you got drafted?
Oh, I got a draft notice from my draft board in Trenton, New Jersey. They didn't know I was in England.
Yeah, and they forwarded it along, your folks did?
Yeah, my folks forwarded it, and I wrote back and said, well, you can't draft me. I'm here on a federal grant.
Yeah.
And they said, no, we're drafting you. So I went off to a draft physical at an Air Force base, an RAF Air Force base where there was a U.S. presence.
Yeah.
And a bunch of Air Force guys.
Yeah.
Basically said, you don't want to go? You don't want to go? All right.
Really?
I mean, they had no dog in the fight.
Right.
It was Army versus Air Force.
Right.
Like a football game.
So So you just went there and you didn't have to act crazy?
I just basically acted like what I was. I just amplified it.
Yeah, which was what?
I just said, I have a pathological fear of conflict. Uh-huh. You know, I had actually attempted to get out of the draft as a conscientious objector,
sure,
because I objected to,
right,
the war.
Right.
But they had completely discarded that.
Yeah, that wasn't working.
That was
anymore.
All like a written application,
yeah,
that was,
right,
rejected.
Right.
So I didn't even attempt that.
So you didn't have to cry or shit your pants?
I did cry. I did cry. I fainted when they drew my blood. I felt so ashamed of myself.
For doing that?
Well, it was like I was acting.
Yeah.
But I wasn't acting for the right reasons, you know. I wasn't acting for an audience and telling a story.
Right, but you feel... You don't have any regrets about that, though, do you?
I think I've lived I thought that regret has stayed with me. You know, that moment for young men, the late 60s, is like a third rail of American society. You,
yeah,
rarely get guys to tell the story of how they got out of the draft.
Uh-huh.
Because there's a lingering shame to that, I think. And yet back in those days, you would get stoned and tell your hilarious story to everybody.
Right.
It was like Alice's Restaurant.
Right.
You know, that big hit song, that big Arlo Guthrie,
sure,
saga was,
sure,
all about pretending to be crazy to get out of the draft and,
yeah,
how it didn't work.
Right.
And he got out of the draft anyway because he had thrown garbage in the wrong place,
right,
a year before, and they saw that he had a record.
You know, yeah.
That was a classic story.
Yeah.
But we all had a comic story, like,
right,
a stand-up comedy routine.
Sure.
Unless you hadn't gone through the agony quite yet.
Right.
Up until then, you were just a nervous wreck. And afterwards, you had your war story too, except that it was an anti-war story.
Yeah, but it's interesting that the shame... It sort of lingers because you didn't man up or that.
There's some element of that. I mean, I remember I worked with a wonderful actor named Dennis Arndt. He's just a terrific guy. And we did a film called Distant Thunder, which was not a successful film. Mm. We were both playing Vietnam bush vets.
Uh-huh.
We shot it up in Vancouver. And Denny and I went and actually hung out with these bush vets in the Olympic Peninsula.
What's a bush vet?
Guys who just went to live in the woods, veterans whose lives were so wrecked that they basically...
Went off the grid. Yeah.
And we hung out with these guys for 3 or 4 days and went to their counseling meetings.
Yeah.
And, oh, God, it was so... And I felt I'm just acting the part. I feel like such a fraud.
Yeah.
And then he had been a chopper pilot in Vietnam. He'd gone through the whole drill.
Yeah.
And I said, Denny, I didn't go, and I can't get interacting with these guys. I can't get over the sense of shame.
Yeah.
And he said, John, I went to Vietnam,
yeah,
and I can't get over my sense of shame. We're all casualties of that war. And it's hard to bring that back to life for people who aren't, you know,
yeah,
over 70 years old.
Right.
And who lived through all that.
Yeah. It's heavy because even in retrospect, obviously I can't understand, but I empathize because I found that, you know, moving. But like even knowing that the war was, you know, unwinnable and a disaster mm-hmm, and based on...
And yet
insanity, you still like, you know, like I.
And yet these guys went, and they went because they felt they had to serve their country, and
yeah,
they made colossal sacrifices.
And they didn't want to go to jail.
Yeah.
And they want to leave the country.
So
it's heavy.
It's a very heavy thing, and back in those days, it dominated everybody's. Men and women, you know, women who felt the terrible guilt of their boyfriends.
Yeah.
I've had that conversation with women my age.
About their boyfriends who bailed?
Who bailed or didn't bail.
Yeah.
I was in London with a lot of American guys,
yeah,
who were just basically self-exiles, and they didn't know what they were going to do.
They were hiding out from the war.
They didn't know how they were going to get home.
When did you go home?
I got home at the end of 2 years,
uh-huh,
of study and went to work for my dad.
In the theater?
Yeah.
doing, you were acting for your father.
I acted and directed and designed.
It's great that you had this dad.
Yeah. I had a fabulous head start. I worked for him for a year.
Hands on.
And then I said, no, Dad, it's time to move, that I got to go and do this myself.
Where'd you go?
To New York, and was out of work for 2 years, you know? Ironically, yeah. I was hired to direct.
Yeah.
I was well on my way to being a director, not an actor.
Yeah.
In fact, Baltimore Center Stage even offered me a job as associate artistic director.
Yeah. You could have been, you could have had a career as a regional theater director.
That's
John.
Right. That's right.
You could.
And I accepted the job because I had nothing else.
Yeah.
And then 2 weeks later, I got the job I always wanted.
Which was
a year's residency at Long Wharf Theater, back when they had a resident company.
Where was that?
New Haven.
So that was your dream, was you were really locked into the theater world.
That was my world. Regional theater was what I did. As a matter of fact, I remember my Fulbright grant application. They asked the question, what will you do with the work you study on this grant? And I said, American Repertory Theater. But the second show I did at Long Wharf, a British play with its American premiere called The Changing Room, about a rugby team in its changing room.
Yeah.
It got a lot of national press.
Yeah.
It was a terrific production. It came intact to Broadway, to 45th Street, and I had my Broadway debut in that. You know, I never thought I'd get to Broadway.
Yeah.
And 2 weeks later, 2 weeks after our opening night, I won a Tony Award for it.
Come on.
Yeah. It was like back in those days, there was no lag time.
Yeah.
I'm sure that
I
am the actor who won a Tony after the shortest time after his debut.
Probably a lot of bitter actors, a lot of angry,
I know,
resentful
actors.
Well,
it was a cast of 22 men, and they weren't entirely celebrating when I won the Best Supporting Actor.
I would imagine the entire theater community in New York was like, who the fuck is this kid?
Exactly. Yeah. You know. That's certainly how I feel most of the time.
So now you're off and running then, huh?
Yeah, back then. I really haven't been seriously out of work since then.
How long was the Focus Theater? When did when did you realize, like, I'm going to do movies? Were you always auditioning for films and television?
No, in the 70s, that was in 1973.
Yeah.
And for about 10 years, I did like 80% plays. I did 12 Broadway plays.
Uh-huh.
And a few movies. I was in All That Jazz.
Oh, yes.
I was in
were the producer?
The director. I'm amazed you even remember. It was a little part.
Hell of a movie, though.
And a great movie.
There was a crew, like there were two or three of the producer types,
yeah, exactly.
Right?
So Fosse even hired genuine people to be...
Oh, you were you were sort of like the...
The arrogant shit, yes.
Right.
And I was sort of the embodiment of all of Fosse's rivals in the business.
Right, but you played in another director, correct? Or was it a producer?
Yeah,
right.
A rival director.
Right, rival director,
and
I remember.
And everybody speculated, who is he? I wore sunglasses on the top of my head.
Right, exactly.
Which is what Hal Prince had always done, you know? But in directing my scenes, Fosse referenced Gower Champion, Mike Nichols, Michael Bennett, and Hal Prince. So he was sort of an embodiment of all the people he was jealous of.
Just this contemptible, arrogant.
Yeah, like that's
and
right.
Every part of your body was just sort of like... Yeah.
And Fosse just loved all that.
He must have been great to work
with.
He
was fantastic, yeah.
And so you did, in the 70s, you did All That Jazz, mm-hmm. and you did, when did you do Blowout?
Blowout, well, I had known De Palma
when
we were both students. He was a student at Columbia and I was at Harvard. And
how do you know him?
We met through I created a sort of summer theater workshop.
Uh-huh.
In Princeton, New Jersey.
I
think the year before the summer before my senior year of college, with a bunch of Columbia guys, a few of us Harvard guys and a few of us Columbia guys.
Uh-huh.
And Brian was a good friend of those guys.
Yeah.
And he came down to see, I remember we were doing a Moliere evening, two, three Moliere one acts, mm-hmm. and I was acting my head off. And I heard this wild, like, banshee laugh from the audience. And the audiences were not big audience. They were not big crowds.
Yeah.
We would fill the theater about 25% full. The whole enterprise was a huge flop.
Yeah.
But I heard this screaming laugh. That was Brian De Palma. And in many ways, he sort of godfathered my entry into movies. He recommended me to the first movie I was ever in.
Yeah.
And then shortly after, he hired me for Obsession.
Yeah.
And then
I never saw Obsession.
You should see it. It's classic old time De Palma. I mean, De Palma's stuff.
I've seen
early
most
on.
Of the movies.
Have you seen Hi Mom and Greetings?
I don't know.
Those are his wild. Those were when
Was. It's written by Paul Schrader.
Yeah. I mean, You got to see them because they were very radical films, and De Niro was in them.
Yeah.
He was in Hi Mom, I think, and Greetings.
Wow, I'm so mad.
But you got to see them because those were his. That's when he was a real renegade.
Yeah.
And then
Blowout was.
Well, I mean, then he became the master of the macabre. You know, he sort of embraced suspense and horror.
Right.
And because he always loved that. And then I did Raising Cain.
Yeah, I saw that. That was
1990.
Heavy. But Blowout was great. Like,
yeah, that was a great one. It was one of his really good ones.
But I don't know what the sort of how he sees his interpretation of other movies, but he clearly does that on purpose.
Oh yeah, yeah. He it's not like he was stealing.
Right.
Always considered it both an homage and a kind of secret in-joke. He delighted in all that.
And what about you playing, like, you know, evil fuckers?
Well, Brian always was curious why he thought of me as. In fact, there's this wonderful documentary of Brian.
Yeah.
It's nothing more than an interview with a lot of cuts to his. And he himself said, I don't know why. I always thought John Lithgow would be a good villain. Uh-huh. I don't know what. He was bemused by that. I think it's because he loves the idea of someone who's apparently innocent being diabolical, and I'm your man for that.
Well, you've done it a lot.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, it's a great way of surprising people. You know, when they expect one thing and it turns out to be another, I mean, that's almost the essence of every kind of drama.
Right.
You know, surprise him.
But then, but luckily, because you work so much, you're not one of those people that when you do a thing like Terms of Endearment, where people are like, no, he's going to be evil at some point. This is going to turn. I've seen him in the last two movies. Someone's going to get a knife in him.
But it goes the other way around. I do Third Rock from the Sun for a few years.
Yeah.
And I'm the last person they think will be evil.
Right.
I'm just this clueless doofus, and then I do Dexter, you know, where I couldn't be more evil. And a lot of the villain parts I've played have a double identity. I love duality, where there's two completely opposite sides to a character.
Yeah.
In fact, about five or six times, I've played my own identical twin.
I mean, that must be a testament to your range and skill as an actor that people will do that. How many people could they really have do that effectively? Obviously, several different directors said, no, John's the guy for this.
Well, I don't know. By now, I've gone in so many crazy different directions. You know, when Stephen Daldry asked me to play Winston Churchill, I was just... I was astonished, and everybody I knew was astonished.
Really?
But I think
Daldry
he'd just seen me do enough unlikely, surprising things. He thought, what a fun idea.
Of course he could do this. And you won an award for that, right?
I won a few awards for that.
Yeah.
An Emmy award. Actually, Albert Finney, rest his soul, won an Emmy for playing Churchill, too. Churchill is a...
And didn't Oldman just
Oldman
get an Oscar?
It's a good prize-winning character. He would have been very pleased, I think.
I think he would, too. And you have an Oscar?
No.
No.
No, I've been nominated twice. And I actually presented one of the nominated films when Billy Crystal was an Oscar host. And he took his eye off the teleprompter for for 1 second.
Yeah.
And he introduced me as a two-time Oscar winner, John Lithgow.
Yeah.
And this is the first time I've ever disabused people of that.
Yeah, I wonder where that came into his head or how that came in. You've won quite a few Emmys.
Yeah, six.
And do you have them all out?
No, I don't. I to tell you the truth, they're in storage. I mean, this sounds ridiculous, but I've got a lot of these
things.
Yeah, and it's like there are too many of them to put on display.
Sure, all the different awards.
It's the Midwesterner in me.
Where do you live here?
Yeah, I live here and have an apartment in New York. So,
oh, that's nice.
I'm a sort of bi-coastal character.
So moving through the movies, though, like I remember, like you're one of those guys that was sort of in a lot of things always. Like I feel like I grew up always seeing you somewhere.
Yeah, like a bad penny.
No,
it keeps on showing up.
But like the Twilight Zone movie, that was great.
Yes, that
was a great role.
Fabulous, and working for George Miller.
Yeah,
you know, of Mad Max. Yeah, Fury Road.
He directed your episode.
He directed my episode, and it was the first time. I'd done a few movies before then.
Yeah,
including Garp.
Sure.
But until then, nobody, no film director had ever asked me to do more. They'd all asked me to do less. But George, nothing was ever enough. More! I want to see your face crack. You know, it was just great.
Terror.
And it was incredibly liberating. That was the first time I brought all my sort of bravura theater chops to the movies.
Really?
Yeah.
So like everything you earn.
Yeah, bam.
How big can I get?
You wanted it, you got it.
Because you are sweating and freaking out.
Total freak out. Through nonstop. It was like a 20-minute heart attack.
Oh, man.
It was really fun.
Did you work with him again ever?
Not George, no.
No.
No, I loved him.
In terms of endearment, like you were the sweet guy.
Yeah, yeah.
He worked at the bank.
It was about a 2 or 3 year stretch, which was, I came out to L.A. When I met my wife, I came to L.A. We got married.
So you left New York, you left the ongoing theater of the 70s.
Yeah. And came out to L.A.
On what movie did you decide, like, I got to go to L.A.?
Well, I decided because of Mary. When we got married, I moved in with her. She was a tenured professor.
Out here?
Yeah, at UCLA.
Uh-huh.
And I couldn't.
That was the first, you've been married twice?
Yeah. Yeah, she's my second wife. And I just, it was just sort of a time for change in my life, I guess.
Yeah.
I moved out. And moved in with her, and bam, 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 bam. I did Garp, Twilight Zone, Terms of Endearment, Footloose, Buckaroo Banzai, all in the space of about Buckaroo 2.5 years. And they were all wildly different character parts.
But popular movies in different ways.
Yeah.
Some of them were big hit movies, right? Terms and Footloose.
Terms, for
Buckaroo
sure.
Buckaroo Banzai, though, had a kind of a cult following.
It still does, yeah.
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 No, what is it? Wherever you go, there you are.
Yeah, and laugh while you can, monkey boy.
Yeah,
that was my. I wish your listeners could see your laugh.
Your
smile.
Yeah, I'd forgotten that one.
Yeah,
monkey it's pretty boy.
Mild. Monkey boy.
That was like a meme before the internet. Like that was something people were saying of that guy.
Yeah.
Monkey boy.
It was the most lunatic character ever. I loved it.
1984. That's right. It was just because I remember that being around. You know, you know how things are around. What was your monkey boy line?
Laugh a while you can, monkey boy. You get a few of those. I once went to I did an assembly at my son's school when he was in high school, and I did my own. It was such a self-congratulatory thing to do. I gave myself a Life Achievement Award.
Oh.
And I provided all
my... Did they ask you to do that?
No. It was a joke.
Oh, okay.
I said, instead of having clips, I just quoted all my great lines.
Yeah.
And I had a whole bunch of them.
What's some of the other ones?
Well, Roberta Muldoon said, I had a great pair of hands, you know.
Yeah.
And laugh while you can, monkey boy. Yeah. And in terms of endearment, you must be from New York. Was, you know, I gave the Harry and the Hendersons howl.
Oh, yeah.
And it was long predated, hello, Dixter Morgan. Mm. You know, that became a.
So you did Third Rock for years.
Yeah, that was 6 years.
But you did a lot of television here and there, a lot of the things that people do. They show up and wave and make a joke and whatever and then go away.
Yeah.
But Third Rock was like, that's a lot, right?
Yeah, we did 138 episodes and had a fantastic time. I mean, it was really a deliriously fun show.
People must know you for that, right?
Probably.
You played H.L. Mencken?
Now that you mention it, I did play H.L. Mencken. No, on Ken Burns, I'm one of his go-to voices. I've been on 4 or 5 of Ken Burns' documentaries.
You didn't do the Vietnam one, though, did you?
That was Peter
Coyote, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I would always do little characters, little letters being read. I was on the Roosevelt one.
Voice work's fun, right?
Well, it's no different from this. We're doing voice work right now.
But you get to do,
it's fun. It's a lark. Yeah. I loved Chris Rock's whole riff on voicing animated films at the Oscars. Oh. It's just, you know, when I did the voice of Lord Farquaad in Shrek, I did it about 4 years before the movie came out.
Yeah.
And it was this whole new technology, Shrek.
Yeah.
It was a very innovative film. And I would go in and lay down some, you know, Lord Farquaad, and then go away for about 6 months, and they'd come in to have me do another 15 minutes to do another little scene.
Yeah.
I maybe dropped in 3 or 4 times over a couple of years.
Right.
It put it all together. I spent about 45 minutes on it.
Right.
And
it lasts forever.
4 years later, out comes this phenomenal film. And it's my voice. I've long since forgotten ever saying these things.
Yeah.
You know?
and it's forever now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who, like my producer, Brendan, he's got a son. A couple years ago when his kid was 6, his wife got tickets to see Peter and the Wolf at Carnegie Hall.
Uh-huh.
And when she told him, he was not happy because he's sensitive. He gets worried about large places and big sounds.
So it caused
him anxiety. And he said, no, I'm not going. Throw the tickets in the trash. And she says, but John Lithgow is going to be the narrator. And there's a long pause, and he says, okay, I'll go.
No, these are my people.
The kids?
Yes, for about a 2-year window of opportunity. Then they grow up and think I'm an asshole. But no, but I've spent a lot of time entertaining like the 3 to 7 year old set.
Yeah. When did that happen? Was that of your own making? Because you've written books. You've done.
Yeah. It's a very nice thing. It mainly came, you know, I had a baby sister 10 years younger than me.
Uh-huh.
There were 4 of us siblings. I was the 3rd oldest, and she was 10 years younger than me.
Yeah.
And I was like her 3rd parent,
right?
Sarah Jane, and I always entertained her,
right?
And always the main go-to babysitter.
Uh-huh.
And then my own kids came along, and I just developed songs. I taught myself the guitar just to sing kids' songs to my kids, and then it was classrooms and benefits for the schools and assemblies and
for their schools, or for then you became known to as a guy who did that.
Not really until Third Rock from the Sun.
Yeah.
And I, at that point, it was like somebody suggested you do something with your kids' stuff.
Yeah.
And I made a home VCR cassette, video cassette. And then I made an album.
Yeah.
With some terrific musicians and a great record producer. And it
of your songs.
Of my songs and also old novelty standards.
Yep.
Cab Calloway and Betty Boop and Shirley Temple songs as retooled as kids' songs.
Sure.
With great sort of old-time jazz orchestration. And I literally called information for Carnegie Hall.
Yeah.
And dialed Carnegie Hall and told them, I have an album.
Yeah.
I want to send it to you and I want to give a concert with a big orchestra.
Yeah.
6 months later, you know.
Come on.
I had my Carnegie Hall debut. I performed there 3 or 4 times. I've I've actually done kids' concerts with about a dozen major U.S. orchestras.
Huh.
Big hour-long concerts, mostly my own songs.
And you sing them?
I sing them. I could sing you one right now.
Okay.
Well, I'm not going to.
I'm in.
All right. Wait, no. I'll sing you one. I got two dogs, Fanny and Blue. Bet you kind of wish I had two dogs, too. Fanny's all white, Blue's kind of gray. They never, ever fight, and they never run away. They're not too smart, but they're loyal and true. There's nothing I'd trade for my Fanny and Blue, etc. I mean, that...
They love it.
Yeah, they go nuts. And they're very interactive concerts. I haven't actually had time to do this for about 3 or 4 years, but I used to do it a lot.
Yeah.
And it was always this wonderful counterpoint to entertaining adults.
Right.
Because kids are electric. I mean, they're an incredibly difficult audience, but if you can control them and stimulate them and then calm them down,
right,
get them to really listen and hold their attention for an entire hour, get them squealing with joy and then totally silent.
Right.
It's a fantastic feeling, because I always say, you know, what an actor really wants is to achieve is suspension of disbelief.
Yeah.
You never get that entirely with an adult audience. They always know they're watching a fiction.
Right.
But kids,
yeah,
they haven't figured anything out yet. They think, my God, I'm seeing the real thing. So, and they have no irony at all.
Yeah.
They just completely buy it.
They're not
cynical.
They
buy it all.
Yeah.
So
they're excited to buy it.
They're so excited. And
it must feel great.
It feels great. And then they grow up and turn their backs on me.
Oh.
Until they discover me in Dexter.
Right. <You know? laughs> or they discover you when they're teaching their own kids stuff.
That's right.
That's
But I mean, the most wonderful thing is to hear parents say, you know, their kids love my albums. It's a wonderful, or my books.
Yeah, because that's evergreen, man.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, you know, those songs, like even the ones that you chose to do that aren't your songs, that you know them for a reason, they never go away.
Yeah.
And if you can make those things that never go away for kids, generations of them, it's an amazing thing.
It was great fun also sort of going through old Tin Pan Alley, because back in the 30s, these ridiculous Inka Dinka Doo Marcy Dotes, they wrote these idiotic songs for commercial adult consumption, but they're wonderful songs for kids. I mean, when I was a kid, Danny Kaye was this huge thing.
Sure.
We had this album that we must have played a million times, Danny at the Palace, doing all these, and I've done several of them on my album.
Oh, you have?
Yeah.
Danny, he was a song and dance. What was his big movie, Danny Kaye?
Hans Christian Andersen.
Oh, yeah.
The Court Jester. And God, you mentioned that to anyone under 50 now, and they have to really struggle.
I can picture his face. I mean,
handsome.
I'm not that old enough to know those things. When I was younger, I was very obsessed with old entertainment somehow.
Mm-hmm. Well, vaudeville. I mean, vaudeville, it reemerges in different strains.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. It never goes away.
Never goes away.
Did you see that Stan and Ollie movie?
No, I didn't.
You should see it.
Is it good?
It's so good.
Yeah, I will.
I'm so mad that it doesn't seem like a lot of people are seeing it.
Well, it's because who knows about Stan and Ollie anymore?
But you know that what they look like. That's all we really know. Even any generation, right, that has seen those black and whites is the whatever's available when you're a kid. But maybe you're right. But the thing is that those two guys, John C. Reilly and Steve Coogan, really, you know, give them depth.
I will see it.
They make them people, and they're people in show business, and they're people in a difficult point in show business in their careers. And it's just such a sweet
movie. I will watch it.
So what's this play you're doing?
That's the one I'm doing with Laurie Metcalf. It's called Hillary and Clinton.
Is it New York or
it'll
here?
It'll be on Broadway.
Okay. And whose play is that?
It's a wonderful young writer named Lucas Nath, H-N-A-T-H. And he wrote, he's written a lot of plays, but he wrote on Broadway, Doll's House 2, a couple of years ago. That, and Laurie played the title role and won the Tony Award for it.
Have you worked with her before?
She came and did a three-episode arc on Third Rock from the Sun.
Okay.
It was hilarious. And she was nominated for an Emmy for it as a guest artist.
She's intense, man.
She is the greatest actress.
Yeah.
Getting up on stage with her, I can't wait.
Yeah.
She is so sharp and got such an attack.
Yeah.
And so smart.
Yeah.
It's really good. And the play is really good.
What's it about?
Well, it's about Bill and Hillary at an at a very crucial moment in their history.
Uh-huh.
It takes place the day before and the day after the New Hampshire primary in 2008, when she was running not against Trump but against Obama.
Yeah,
and it's in a sense it's kind of like The Crown, where there are these very extremely well-known public figures that everybody's obsessed with, but nobody really knows what's inside their lives, their private lives, and it's a kind of hypothetical and speculative play, but it's a this guy is such a tremendous writer. It's got the dramatic structure of an Ibsen play. It's a very funny play, but it's got turns of plot that the storytelling is just great. They don't write plays like this anymore. I just love it.
Well, that's great. So to play Bill Clinton, how do you not make that a caricature?
Well, it's a kind of a deal is made with the audience almost instantly. Out comes Laurie, just as Laurie, and says, basically, don't worry. We're not even trying to imitate these people. It's just an alternate take on them. So I'm not making the slightest effort to look like him or sound like him.
Huh.
You'll see. You got to see it. It's going to be just tremendous. It's a four-character play.
Who are the other two characters?
I don't think I'll tell you because one of them's a big surprise.
Oh, can't spoil it? No spoilers.
That's right.
Got it. And, well, it sounds interesting. And certainly the two of you guys together, that's crazy. That's going to be something. And what's the Fox News movie?
Ah, well, I'm playing Roger Ailes.
How is that playing another monster?
Well, it all depends on how you look at him.
Objectively.
Yes, he was a monster, but whenever I play a monster, I sort of shake hands with him.
Sure, you give him
it's humanity. It's a terrific script by Charles Randolph, who co-wrote The Big Short. It's directed by Jay Roach, a wonderful director.
He does good comedy movies, right?
And this cast, it's me, but the other major characters are the women at Fox.
Sure.
It's really about the women's response to the culture.
Who plays Megyn Kelly again?
Megyn Kelly is played by Charlize Theron.
Oh, yeah.
And Nicole Kidman
plays
Gretchen Carlson. Margot Robbie, Allison Janney, Connie Britton, Kate McKinnon. It's the most extraordinary ensemble.
Powerful.
Great, great actresses.
That's a powerful bunch of women there.
And it's such a smart piece. I mean, you never know. You're inside it all, but...
Have you seen a cut?
No.
When's it out?
Well, you know, it's a very, very glorified independent film. It's not a studio film. It's not slated. I don't think it's even titled yet. But it's really going to be good, I think.
Well,
it certainly felt great acting those scenes. And they're very challenging scenes. We've been obsessed with the Me Too movement and the downfall of all these harassers for the last couple of years. But you never, I don't think I have seen it accurately portrayed. There's no way of accurately recreating what actually happened behind closed doors.
Right, but exploring the other side of it.
Yes, and in depth, like all of the... what's most fascinating is all the different reactions of all the different women.
Yeah.
Because, you know, some people, for all sorts of complex reasons, have to either accommodate or not accommodate, defy, or protest, sue, or accept. And Everyone in the film faces a deep moral dilemma, including Ailes himself, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
You know, Connie Britton plays this fascinating part of his wife. Allison plays his attorney, Susan Estrich, who was a feminist and a great advocate for women and protecting women.
That's complex.
It's very
movie.
Complex. It's a complex story. And the background, of course, is the birth of Fox News.
Mm-hmm.
Roger Ailes created Fox News, and his downfall has all kinds of resonance with what's happening right now.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds exciting. It's all done, right?
It's all shot. You know, they're cutting it, and Jay's very happy.
Oh, good.
He sent me an email saying, wow, this is really working.
So oh, good.
That's always good.
That's great. I met him on a plane briefly.
Yeah.
So you're going to do the play. That's coming out. And what else? That's enough.
Huh? I'm writing a book.
Really?
Yeah.
About yourself?
No.
Oh, good.
It's... No. I've done that.
Yeah, I've done a couple of those.
No, it is so... it's a project in such infancy.
Yes.
I hesitate to even talk about it.
It's
satirical doggerel verse on the subject of the Trump administration and all these astounding characters. I mean, if you just look at it, an actor looking at this list of characters, there's about 50 of them who are so unbelievably bizarre.
Yeah.
Comic, appalling, horrific, scary.
Yeah, the worst. Yeah.
The worst.
They are almost as if they are satirical characters.
Yeah. It's like...
What's doggerel verse?
It's doggerel verse. It's nonsense verse. But
okay.
It's like Lewis Carroll and Edward Lear.
Oh, so you're going to do a funny poetry...
It's comic. To me, the only way I can deal with my kind of chronic low-level depression about the state of this country is to make some sort of comic comment on it.
Yeah, I'm up on it. Yep. I'm up on the decline. Well, good.
Up on the decline. Yeah, I like that phrase. It's not going to last forever. I'm an optimist by nature.
Oh, good. I think I am, but I don't know... I think it's just it's some sort of denial thing.
Of course it is, we do forget. It's almost like, you know, you can get addicted to a streaming drama, created for Netflix or Amazon.
Right.
I try to think of this as the streaming drama of our lives. When I think back to my young years, one of the great villains of my childhood was Richard Nixon.
Sure.
All through the 50s, you know, Yellow Springs, Ohio, he was he and Joe McCarthy and Roy Cohn, those were the great boogeymen.
Right.
As a result, his come down in 1973 or 4.
Took a while.
It took a while, but when it came, it was one of the great moments of elation in my childhood. I think I have that coming.
Oh, good.
I think there's a second coming.
We all have that coming. did you go, I read that you gave a commencement at Harvard and you were the first actor to do so?
Yes, first and only so far.
And was that a big moment or no?
Oh, it was wonderful.
Yeah.
It was fantastic. As a matter of fact, I used my children's books as kind of the theme. I wrote a children's book for the occasion.
Uh-huh.
It was a lot of fun because that year there had been a kind of outrage. Their then president, Lawrence Summers, had made an offhand comment about women not being suited for science.
Oh, right.
And it was really, it cost him his presidency. There was such an outrage.
Yeah.
And that outrage was boiling all year long. So I'm convinced they invited me to give the commencement speech because I was the least offensive person they could think of.
Yeah.
And I decided to write a children's book for the occasion, to give a boilerplate commencement speech, but end it with something that I had done.
Yeah.
As my theme was be creative, be useful, be practical, be generous.
And
I said, okay, I'm creative. I've created a book for the occasion. Practical, it's going to be published.
Yeah.
Useful, well, it's going to help pour oil on troubled waters here at Harvard this year.
Uh-huh.
It's about a mouse a little girl mouse named Mahalia, who happens to be brilliant at science. and the laughter just rolled across these 20,000 people sitting outside in the sunshine. Yeah. And I then recited this verse, children's book called Mahalia Mouse Goes to College.
Uh-huh.
And it was all about a brilliant little science student who ends up graduating from Harvard.
Yeah.
And I said, I dedicated it to the class of 2005, and all my proceeds went to their class gift. That was my little homily.
So you published it?
It's published. It's a terrific book.
Oh, good.
And I got a standing ovation, and I performed an encore of one of my children's songs.
That's great. And you stuck it to the man.
He was seated right behind me. No, but it was very gentle.
You weren't going like this guy.
It's like I couldn't let the moment pass without giving some nod to the thing that had obsessed the campus all year long.
And you did it from a child's perspective.
Yes, right.
Which made everybody process it in that way.
Yeah.
It wasn't an intellectual thing, right?
Right.
Yeah, that's great. Well, it's great talking to you, man.
Oh, God, are we done?
Yeah, I think so.
It's wonderful talking to you, Mark.
And
you do such great things with this.
I'm really proud
to be on it.
Oh, thanks. So. Good luck with the play.
Thank you.
Break a
leg.
You've
got to come see it. You've got to promise me you'll come to see it.
When I'm going to New York, I want to see a couple plays. I'll see that one. I'm going to see the Miller play.
Yeah.
And
Tracy's a good friend of yours, huh?
We're new friends. It's weird when you're at middle age and making friends. Yes.
Yeah.
I talk about it a lot, but we've spent time together. We've gone out and ate, and I've seen his plays.
He's such a bright man.
Yeah. I like making him laugh. He's a good audience for me somehow.
I don't know him very well, but I saw him at the Steppenwolf years ago in a great
play. Good actor.
Yeah, he's a terrific actor.
Yeah, and his plays are good. This is good. The new one down at the Mark Taper.
Yes, State. I heard you talking about it on.
Yeah, I liked
year.
It. If you're a certain type of fella, it's going to relate to a little hard.
Yeah,
it's going to resonate with you in ways that are going to make you uncomfortable.
Well, that's one of the things we try to do.
That's what theater's for.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, man.
Great to talk to you.
Okay, that was great. I love that guy. And now I will pray. Fuck my mouth. Jesus, fuck. It's like some days. And now I will play. Now I will play. Play guitar. Play. Huh, God damn it. Play. Here we go. Boomer lives.